We come to kind of a unique passage in the Gospel of Luke. Because of the four Gospels that we have, only Luke records a story about the childhood of Jesus. Matthew and Luke have their infancy narratives where we see about the birth of Jesus. The Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of John begin with Jesus as an adult. But only Luke, in this section, gives us any indication of events that happen in Jesus' life during his upbringing. Now, I want to share a few things with you. This is more for, two reasons. Curiosity's sake, maybe to give you a bit of information. But it also is something that can help us to identify the historicity of the events. Because one of the things that happens in the ancient world is when people make stuff up, they really make stuff up. They embellish things and make them larger than life. But the account in Luke chapter 2 here, when Jesus is 12 years old and they go up to the temple for Passover, it's a very plain story. There's no miracles or anything like this. But just as we like to fill in the blanks nowadays, we don't like when there's gaps. In the ancient world, they didn't either. And this is some stuff that came out in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. For instance, there is an ancient work called the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, and part of it reads this. And just to preface this, this story is also in the Quran. So Muhammad was familiar with this story. And this is what it says. It says, when this boy Jesus was 5 years old, he was playing out on the crossing of a stream. And he gathered together into pools the running water and instantly made it clean and gave his command with a single word. Having made soft clay, he molded from it 12 sparrows. And it was the Sabbath when he did these things. And there were also many other children playing with him. When a certain Jew saw what Jesus was doing while playing on the Sabbath, he at once went and told his father Joseph, "See, your child is at the stream, and he took clay and molded 12 birds and has profaned the Sabbath." And when Jesus came to the place, and look, he cried out to him, saying, "Why do you do on the Sabbath the things which it is not lawful to do?" But Jesus clapped his hands and cried out to the sparrows and said to them, "Be gone." And the sparrows took flight and went away chirping. The Jews were amazed when they saw this and went away and told their leaders what they had seen Jesus do. Another example, it says in the same work, after this, he again went through the village and a child ran and knocked against his shoulder. Jesus was angered and said to him, "You shall not go further on your way." And immediately he fell down and died. There's other stories. I'm just going to give you a few. Later on, again, in the same work. Now, after some days, Jesus was playing in the upper story of a house, and one of the children who was playing with him fell down from the house and died. And when the other children saw it, they fled, and Jesus remained alone. And the parents of the one who was dead came and accused him, but they threatened him. Then Jesus leaped down from the roof and stood by the corpse of the child and cried with a loud voice, "Zeno!" For that is what he was called. "Arise and tell me, did I throw you down?" And he arose at once and said, "No, Lord, you did not throw me down, but raise me up." After a few days, a certain man was cleaving wood in a corner, and the axe fell and split the sole of his foot. And he was losing so much blood that he was about to die. And there was a clamor, and a crowd gathered. And the child Jesus also ran there, forced his way through the crowd, and took the injured foot, and it was healed immediately. And he said to the young man, "Arise now, cleave the wood, and remember me." And then it continues on. Another work called the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew. It's called that because it's attributed to Matthew, who wrote the first Gospel, but he didn't write it. It was written about 2 centuries later. It says, having come to a certain cave and wishing to rest in it, Mary dismounted from her beast and sat down with the child Jesus in her lap. And on the journey, there was with them. Now, this one's really interesting. This one's bedtime story stuff. With Joseph, three boys, and with Mary, a girl. And behold, suddenly there came out of the cave many dragons, And when the boys saw them, they cried out in great terror. Then Jesus got down from his mother's lap and stood on his feet before the dragons, and they worshipped Jesus and then departed. Then was fulfilled that which was said by David the prophet, "Praise the Lord from the earth, dragons and all you ocean depths." So Jesus tamed the dragons. Here's another one. After this, while they were going on their way, on their journey, Joseph said to Jesus, they're going to Egypt. This is filling in the blanks of when they were told to get up and go to Egypt. So we know that Jesus must be really, really, really small when this happened. Joseph said to Jesus, "Lord, the heat is roasting us. If it please you, let us go by the seashore that we may be able to rest in the cities on the coast." Jesus said to him, "Fear not, Joseph. I will shorten the way for you, so that what would have taken 30 days to traverse, you shall accomplish in this one day." And then it goes on to say that by the end of the day, they're seeing the cities in Egypt and they arrive. I won't pain you with much more. Here's another one. Arabic infancy gospel. It's called that because it's written in Arabic. On the day after, a woman took scented water to wash the Lord Jesus. And after she had washed him, she took the water, she had done it, and poured some of it upon a girl who was living there and whose body was white with leprosy, and washed her with it. As soon as this was done, the girl was cleansed from her leprosy. And then there are other things. You can see what they do later on. There's some legends in that same work later on about what Jesus was talking with these people with when he was in the temple when he was 12 years old. And one says, well, they brought in this man who was an expert in astronomy. And so Jesus goes on this long diatribe, you know, explaining to him how the planets work and all these things. And of course, he's 12 years old. And then they bring in somebody who's a medical doctor. Jesus begins to explain to him everything about the human body and diseases and these sorts of things, because they're trying to fill in the gaps and make everything greater than it is. And this argues for the historicity of the event, because what we see when we compare it with other literature, when people make stuff up, it becomes very obvious and transparent when they do make it up. And so we can be rest assured that the story here in Luke chapter 2 is an accurate recounting of the events. Part of the later development, though, is that Jesus becomes the teacher and not the student. Well, in the story here, you have to be careful. Jesus is not the teacher. He's the student. What they're amazed is the answers that he gives to the questions that they give him. Not that they're saying, well, we don't really know this. Can you explain it to us? There's none of that. So you have an outline in your bulletin. And I want to tell you right off the bat the two main points to take from this. We're going to go through the historical narrative, but there's two main points that you need to get out of this. Number one, you may want to write this down, is the priority of God. Or you might call this your priority of your relationship with God. And the second one is the uniqueness of Jesus. And this is subtly beginning to unveil in this text here, the uniqueness of Jesus. The text begins with an introduction. Verse 41. Every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the festival, or for the Passover. So this is something that every year Jesus' family would do. We don't know whether Jesus went before or whether in the next verse that's recounting the first time Jesus went. Now, according to the Old Testament, there were three feasts which we might call pilgrimage feasts. In other words, these feasts, all the men were required to head to Jerusalem to celebrate these feasts. These are Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. If you want to turn to Exodus chapter 23, page 74 in the Pew Bible, I'll begin reading verse 14. Exodus 23, verse 14. 3 times a year you are to celebrate a festival to me. Celebrate the festival of unleavened bread. For 7 days eat bread made without yeast, as I commanded you. Do this at the appointed time in the month of Abib. For in that month you came out of Egypt. No one is to appear before me empty-handed. Celebrate the festival of harvest with the first fruits of the crops you sow in your field, celebrate the festival of ingathering at the end of the year. These are the ones that I mentioned. These are just different names for them. So the Pentecost is the one that's called here the festival of harvest. And then the tabernacles or booths is the last one there, the festival of ingathering. Three times a year, all the men are to appear before the sovereign Lord. And then if you turn over to chapter 34, and verse 22, page 85. Celebrate the festival of weeks, so Pentecost, the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the festival of ingathering. At the turn of the year, three times a year, all your men are to appear before the sovereign Lord, the God of Israel. And then in Deuteronomy 16:16, we have the same sort of thing. So while there was other things that they celebrated and other events in the calendar, these were the three that it was required, no matter where you live, that you pack your bags and you head down. And so by the time of the New Testament, though, much of the nation had been scattered throughout the known world. In 722, when the Assyrians came down and they defeated the northern kingdom, Israel, they took them into captivity. And the Assyrian policy was you take a few, you stick them here. You take another few, you stick them here. And you disperse them everywhere. Well, what happens? You end up with a Heinz 57 group in every area. Because eventually they must interbreed with the other nations that are around them. And you get mixed cultures. That's why they call them the 10 lost tribes. Not because nobody knows where to find them, but because they intermarried with others. When the Assyrians, they left some of the poor Jews in the northern kingdom. And then what they did is they took people from other nations and stuck them in Israel. And that group that developed became the Samaritans. So you had people who are half Jewish and then half something else. And they became the Samaritans. Passover of those three feasts was the king feast. It was the one that everybody looked forward to. And it was followed by the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so by the New Testament times, they were considered one thing. Passover, the major feast celebrated at the beginning of the Jewish year, begins on the 15th day of Nisan, which in our calendar falls in March or April. It's easy for us because this happens in conjunction with Easter. Because we believe that Jesus, when he ate the Last Supper, that was a Passover meal. And so we can look at this with when we have our Easter. It recounted the miraculous deliverance of the nation from Egypt. You'll recall that the original Passover was associated with the 10th plague. God had sent plagues upon Pharaoh and upon the Egyptians, and the 10th plague was that God was going to send the angel of death to come and kill the firstborn sons. And what God did is he had them celebrate the Passover for two things. One, the appropriation of the blood of the lamb was to be placed on the doorpost and the lintel. And that as the angel came, when he saw the blood, he would pass over, hence the name, that house. And of course, the Passover also, they were to eat it and they were to do it in a certain way. It was unleavened bread because they were to eat it in haste, not have enough time to let the yeast rise. And also they were to eat it with their coat on and with their walking stick in hand and so forth and so on. And when the Passover was fulfilled, the next day, that's when Pharaoh said, go. And so it led to the Exodus. And this became a key event, if not the key event, in Israel's history. Everywhere you look in the Old Testament, God's the one who led us out of Egypt. And that's the thing that they clung on to. And so this was something that they looked forward to going. But by the first century, since people lived everywhere, a lot of the pious people, they might only be able to come once in a lifetime. Or maybe if they lived not that far away, instead of coming up to the three feasts, they would only come to one. And if they were going to choose, they'd make sure that it was Passover. We have several holidays, so to speak. We have Christmas and Easter. For them, it was like Christmas for them. This is the one that we want. So the unleavened bread and the Passover were celebrated together, and it became a 7 or 8 day long festival. The Jews were only required to go to the first 2 days, which was the Passover, but many of them would stay for the entire week. In the entire week, and in the next verse, verse 43 actually implies that they stayed for the entire week. The trip from Nazareth would be about 80 miles or so, and they would most likely go around Samaria. And villages would travel together in a caravan. Part of the route that they would take, you would be going through kind of treacherous areas where you'd be enclosed in, and robbers and bandits and things would wait. And so you would travel in these larger caravans because there's safety in numbers. The story of the Good Samaritan would resonate with people when you have somebody going from Jericho. That road there was known to go through a pass where it was known that the robbers would hide out. And so people could resonate with that story of somebody getting jumped along the way, getting beaten to a pulp and robbed. That would be something that would be, in the newspaper on a regular basis. They'd be familiar with it. And in fact, to help during this process, they would actually station some of the military along these areas at the time to prevent the robberies from happening. So this is talks about the piety of Jesus' parents, because they go to the effort to do this every year. And it's interesting, though. In our modern culture, people have a hard enough time going to church, but these people had to literally, go on a 3 to 5 day walk to get to this place, and at great expense to them. You got to go and you got to get a hotel or stay with family or something for a week, plus your travel. It's at least a 2 week trip by the time you, they willingly did this. Verse 42, when he was 12 years old, so they're looking at a unique occasion when they were doing this celebration of the Passover. We don't know if this is the first time Jesus went or this is just something that happened on that particular year. Some people try to say that Jesus was going up for his bar mitzvah. The bar mitzvah didn't happen until later on in history. There was no such thing as this time. A bat mitzvah. The bat mitzvah is for the girls. Here in Judaism in the first century, you weren't considered to have to obey the Mosaic law and the 613 commandments and all the other oral laws until you turned 13. A 13-year-old male was considered a man. So if you're 13, how old are you? 13? So in Judaism, you're a man. You're a man. Okay, you would reach manhood. And so when they were 12, they would be really, really catechized in a way where they were preparing them for manhood when they turned 13. And so some think that maybe Jesus was brought along in his 12th year because the next year, according to the oral law, he would have to go up. And so they're saying, okay, Jesus, you can come and you can just watch and learn the ropes. And then next year you'll know what is required of you. That may be the case. The text doesn't tell us, though. But this occurs in his 12th year. They went up to the festival according to the custom. After the festival was over, the wording that's used here implies directly that it's the entire 7 day festival. Which again is another cue on the piety of Jesus' family. They don't do the bare minimum. They do above the law, so to speak, greater than what the law requires. So after the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind. Luke does not care to fill in the details. We're not told why his parents left without him, why Jesus stayed. That's kind of filled in the blanks a little bit, but there's so many things that are left kind of out of the story, and it's because it has nothing to do with his purpose, which I think is those two things I told you at the beginning. The priority of God and the uniqueness of Jesus. So, don't start analyzing his parents psychologically and that they're bad parents and these sort of things. There is nothing in here about that, and I'll explain some of the culture at the time would have been going on. So after it was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but they were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day. Now, it's going to go on to explain that they search among their family and friends. If the entire village is going, they probably think, you know what, Jesus is just playing with his buddies, or he's with his grandparents, or his cousins, or something. That's what they're thinking. And everyone who has kids can relate to this somehow. You know, you think your kids are with so-and-so, then you find out they're not. And so, you know, this is just what's going on. It's nothing about their bad parents. In fact, the precociousness of Jesus implies here that his parents have well-versed him in Judaism. So thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day. There's later tradition, but it's centuries later. We don't know if it went back to this time, but that the women and children were up ahead and the men were in the back. I don't know if that means that the bandits get them first so the men can run away. But that's a later tradition, and there's no evidence for it at the New Testament time. But maybe they just assumed that, you know, all the kids were together. At nighttime, before, you know, dinner time, getting ready for bed, then everybody goes and gets their kids. And it's at this point that they find out, uh-oh, we're short a number. Jesus isn't here. Where is he? And so they've traveled a day, about 20 miles. People traveled about 20 miles a day in these caravans. And so, uh-oh, he's not with us. He must be back there. So they turn around and they go another 20 miles back to Jerusalem. Thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day. Then they began looking for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. Now, as a parent, I can just imagine what's going through their mind now. You know, on the brink of a heart attack, thinking something bad's happened to their child. And so they're rushing back. After 3 days, which actually means here on the third day. That's not what the Greek means, but that's what the text implies. In other words, they're not in Jerusalem looking for him for 3 days. So 5 days have gone by. But the idea is 1 day away from Jerusalem, 1 day back, on the third day they find him. So from Jesus' perspective, it's 3 days. Now, Semitic concept, 2 plus anything implies the third day. So it doesn't mean that, what's 24 times 3 days? 72? Okay, so it doesn't imply that 72 hours must have transpired. It means 48 plus, or actually it doesn't even mean that. It means part of 1 day, all of another, and some of the next. Now, in this case, because they're heading out, it would be all of day one, all of day two, and maybe first thing in the morning they find him. But anyways, just so you know, that's what the text is implying. So they find him on the third day. And then we start the dialogue. This is the first time we hear Jesus speak in Luke's gospel. And so it says, after 3 days, they found him in the temple courts. There are two words for temple. One refers to kind of the inner sanctuary. This is where the priest would go. This is where the Holy of Holies would be, the altar and all the furniture. Luke doesn't use that word. He uses the word that refers either to the whole thing or to the outer structure. So this would be where the court of the Gentiles is, the court of the women. This is where there was different houses. There was a little house for leprosy, which is where if somebody was cured of leprosy, they would go and offer sacrifice. And there was different things. There was Solomon's colony. This is where, when it talks about Jesus going up the temple and teaching people, this is that outer court area. We know it has to be the outer court anyways because Mary goes there. If Mary goes into the inner court, she's a goner. Women were not allowed to go past the court of the women, there. The same thing, there was an outer court, which is the court of the Gentiles. There's a bunch of gates that go all around, and there were signs on the gates that says, if you're a Gentile, and if you go through that door, then you're going to be put to death. In fact, in first century in Israel, the only thing that the Jews were allowed to put somebody to death for was for that. Everything else had to go through the Roman judicial system. That's why when they want to put Jesus to death, they can't just do it, but they have to go through Pilate. But if Jesus was a Gentile and he had walked into the court of women, then they could have stoned him to death there, and they would have been within their legal rights. You may recall later on the story of Paul when he comes back to Jerusalem, and he brings somebody with him. They think he's a Gentile, and they think that Paul has brought him into the temple precincts and that, and they go to stone him. A riot breaks out because of this concept of the boundaries that were set up in this. Okay, so Jesus in this outer one, upon one of the walls there was a little area where the old Sanhedrin met. It was a place called it was thought to be carved out. And so just outside of that, there was a set of stairs, and the rabbis and things would teach on those stairs. And so that's one of the locations. If you have one of those ESV study Bibles, they actually have a beautiful picture of the temple there, and they actually show you the area that it could have been. It's in and around where this story is, for those who are using that. So Jesus is there, and the rabbis would sit on the ground, and the students would sit at the feet of the rabbis. They wouldn't sit higher up, but they would sit on the ground together. This was the rabbinic tradition. And they usually taught by a series of questions and answers. So the rabbis would ask them questions, or the students had opportunities to ask. And it was kind of this probing dialogue. It wasn't an iron sharpening thing, but this is the way in which the rabbis would teach others. So Jesus is sitting at their feet, and these are supposedly the theologians of the day. And we read here that he was sitting among the teachers. Among doesn't mean here that he's sitting among them in the sense that he is one of them. It should be understood that he's sitting at the feet of the teachers. He's not teaching them. Because it even says, listening to them and asking them questions. Now, not like he asks them questions later on. Later on when he asks them questions, it's because he knows their theology is seriously flawed. By the way, this is the only time that they're called teachers. Later on, that is saved for Jesus or John the Baptist or Jesus' disciples. They're called teachers. But here it's used in a neutral sense because the antagonism between Jesus and these people hasn't come to the forefront. It's when Jesus begins his adult ministry that it immediately begins. You actually see it, not from Jesus' lips, from John the Baptist, in the very next chapter, when verse 7, John said to the crowds coming out to be baptized, and he's referring to the religious leaders that are among, he says, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come?" So we already see some antagonism building right in on the next page. Verse 47, everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. Now, the word amazed here should be understood in a very strong sense. They were just kind of wondering, how is it possible? This word, even though this isn't Luke's intention, elsewhere in Luke's gospel, when he uses this word, it refers to something that it has a miracle or God attached to it. So, for instance, when the angel appears and says something, they were amazed. It almost has some sort of divine revelation concept to it. Here it doesn't have that, but it's meant to be understood as a very strong term. You know, they're seeing something special, something unique. This child is very precocious. Although nowadays every kid's precocious, right? When they're speaking about their own. But they're using this in a very narrow sense that Jesus, among his peers, there's no equal. They're shocked at his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. Doesn't say why they're astonished. Doesn't mean they're astonished because they see him in the temple there. Oh, we found him. They're astonished. What's he doing here? Or are they astonished because maybe they've been listening in on the conversation? They're hearing these people oohing and aahing over their son. We don't know. We don't know. It seems by Jesus' reply, it's more they're astonished that they found him in the temple because of Jesus' response. He says, first of all, he says, why are you looking for me? It's kind of strange. A 12-year-old says that to his parents when that's like, you leave your kid in Toronto and then you go back and find your child and they say, how come you were looking for me? I've only been here 3 days. He went up to the big city. Here, backwoods Galilean from Nazareth, they've gone up to the big city. And Jesus, his question or his statement is meant to say, first of all, Mary says to him, and notice the wording. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, son, why have you treated us like this? Now, she could have said here, we have been anxiously searching for you. But the wording is intentional. Your father and I. There's a play off this. Father, my father's house. There's a hint here that already the relationship between Jesus and his earthly parents, that there's a separation undergoing. Not a falling out, but that Jesus' relationship to his heavenly father supersedes that of his earthly parents. It's nothing saying, well, Joseph, he's really not my father. He's not pulling that. Jesus would have considered Joseph to be his father. He was his legal father through adoption. So they said, your father and I have been anxiously searching for you. The word anxiously here has the idea I can't even describe it. You're in the shopping center. You're in the clothing room. You turn and your child's gone. You know that feeling you have that you can't even describe? Okay, that's what anxious means here. When their heart is in their throat and they can't even, they can't even breathe. That's what's going on. There's also by now this sense of relief that they found him. We have been anxiously searching for you. Jesus' response, why were you searching for me? Now, this could mean one of two things. Either you should have just went home. Eventually, I would have caught up with you. Don't worry about it. Or this could mean, why were you searching for me? You should have just come straight to the temple. You should have known that that's where I would have been. In other words, Jesus isn't even addressing the question of the anxiously or how come you didn't come with us, but just the concept of, you shouldn't have searched anyways. You should have just come right back to the temple. This whole dialogue of, why Jesus didn't go for his parents or he didn't at least tell them where he was going to be or this, that plays no role in Luke's story, so we won't psychologize that or look into that because Luke's point has nothing to do with that. He asks, did you not know I had to be in my father's house? Now, I have a little note here that says, or be about my father's business. The Greek text actually says something like this. It actually says something like, did you not know I had to be father's? It doesn't identify house or business. The King James, New King James have about, I had to be about my father's business. Everyone else basically has about, I had to be in my father's temple. The reason for that is that if he just said about my father's business, then his parents would have said, well, couldn't you have done that at home? In other words, what is it about the business that made you had to be in the temple? It's more likely I had to be in my father's house. The reason for this is that God's presence was associated with the temple, and also the center of learning was in the temple. And so Jesus is saying there, I need to be here because I needed to be fed. I needed to be where my Father is. I needed to be close to my Father. So Jesus is giving them a spiritual answer. And so there's this separation between them. And this is where our first point where I said priority of God. Jesus here is already letting them know that his relationship with his heavenly Father supersedes his relationship with them. Now, this doesn't mean if any other kid did that, they're going to go to church and stay there for 3 days and they can use this as an excuse. Jesus is unique. Mary and Joseph already have been told this. He is Messiah. He is the Son of God. So they complain. Jesus responds by saying that he must be in his Father's house. But they did not understand what he was saying. They didn't get the spiritual significance to what he's saying. They knew the words that came off his lips. They were speaking the same language, but they didn't understand, the depth of what he was trying to get across. Well, why do you need to be here? We've been here for a week. Wasn't that enough? Can't you pray to God, talk to God, back in Nazareth? And this isn't fleshed out in the text. The remainder of the gospel is going to continue to show us the uniqueness of Jesus. We're going to see more of the separation between him and his parents. Jesus, your mother and your family's here. Who are they? Aren't you and you and you and you my mother and brothers and sisters? We already see that gap. Those who belong to God in a spiritual sense are his family. Especially at this time because Jesus' parents weren't, we'd say, born again at this time. We know that they were after the resurrection because they're all in the upper room. And Paul tells the 1 Corinthians 15 that it was the resurrection why James was converted. So he says, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So the main point is misunderstood. They just don't understand it. And maybe they say, okay, well, maybe you can explain it to us later on. Then he went down to Nazareth. It's down. Everything in the Bible is considered down from Jerusalem. Even though Jerusalem isn't the highest point, technically Bethlehem is higher than Jerusalem. But you still say you go up to Jerusalem. Now, it's about 700 feet lower to Nazareth, so it is downhill. So they go back. This is the exact reverse of when they said they went up to Jerusalem. They went down to Nazareth he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. So even though Jesus already recognizes the difference between his heavenly Father and his parents, because God's law says that he is to obey his parents and to honor them, Jesus does this. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. Again, that means that she pondered them over for the significance. There was much to her son that she didn't get. Some people have used this phrase over and over again for this narrative. They say there was more to Jesus than meets the eye. Even though they had been given all this supernatural revelation about him. He's going to be the Christ. He's going to save his people from their sins. The one born, he's going to be the Son of God, so forth and so on. They still didn't get it. They had their own view of what Messiah would be like. And he wasn't fitting the profile. Apart from this incident, the word assumed that Jesus had an everyday, ordinary childhood. And Jesus grew up. This here means he physically grew up. He physically matured. So he's 12, then he was 13, 14, 15, 16. He grew up like any other boy into a man. He increased in wisdom and in favor with God and people. The in favor with God means because he lived an obedient life to God, he was a godly man, that God's blessing was upon him. But it also means that his people liked him. He must have been just a good person. People respected him. It was later on they didn't because they didn't like his theology. People don't like theology when it makes them uncomfortable. You make them squirm a bit or doesn't fit their preconceived notions, and so they didn't like Jesus. No, the one we're going to develop next time is where it says he increased in wisdom. We're going to look at the incarnation and the concept of how can Jesus, who is said to be God and therefore omniscient, grow in wisdom and knowledge? How can somebody who is infinite in wisdom grow in wisdom? Wasn't Jesus already all-knowing? Wasn't he already all-powerful? In other words, is the incarnation, when we talk about God taking on flesh, something that is comprehensible? Is it logical? Or are Christians just grabbing on to something that's a logical contradiction? I mentioned to the youth in Sunday school class that if the Bible teaches a lie, then stop believing the Bible. That's a big statement, but it's an accurate statement. Because the Bible is either God's word or it isn't. God can't lie. Therefore, the Bible can't lie. And so if the Bible teaches something that is logically impossible, something that is not truth, something that is a lie, then you should disbelieve the Bible. And so if we can't make sense of the incarnation, then there's something wrong. Now, so I don't make you sweat, I'm going to show you next week that we can easily make sense of the incarnation and there isn't a logical contradiction and that we can make this fit nice and neatly together. And it's not one of those things where you have a jigsaw puzzle and you bring out a pair of scissors so you can make the piece fit. We're not going to do that. We're going to show that the pieces fit nice and neatly together all by themselves. 2 points this morning. The second one first, the uniqueness of Jesus. The teachers see something unique about Jesus in the way in which he's responding to them. But secondly, when Jesus makes the statement, I must be in my Father's house, there is something there that must be understood in a metaphysical sense. And by that I mean that Jesus means that in a sense that his real metaphysical, ontological Father is God. So those big words mean that Jesus there in that statement is making a claim to be God. That he is a unique, special relationship to God. And so right off the bat, we have the uniqueness of Jesus. But secondly is the priority of God. And this is something that is directly applicable to us. That is, Jesus saw that his relationship to God superseded every other relationship. So folks, you're setting a priority for your life. The number one priority in your life is your relationship to God. Your walk with God is most important. So, who's more important? Let's just whip through these really quickly. Who's more important, your wife or God? Your husband. So, which relationship should supersede it? Your relationship to God or your relationship to your spouse? God. What about your children? Boyfriend, girlfriend. Job. Church. Oh, there's one for you. The point is, your relationship to God is first and foremost. You cannot allow anything to come into your life that is going to negatively affect your relationship with God. When you counsel people about getting married, a few things. You tell them, don't marry a non-Christian. Why? Because their relationship with you is going to affect your relationship with God. Paul says, 2 Corinthians chapter 7, he says, what does light have to do with darkness? There's such a they don't fit together at all. It's apples and oranges. And it doesn't help you in your relationship with God. We can put this down. You know what? You want to make your marriage better? Help your spouse to be a better Christian. That's going to help them in their walk with God. It's going to help you with your walk with God, make everything great. So make your priority with God, your relationship with Him, number one. And if anything is affecting that, get rid of it. Your TV's causing you to stumble in your relationship with God, you know what? Put it out on the curb. I know a friend who was, he was watching some movies that he shouldn't have. His dad told him, if I ever catch you again, guess where the VCR is going to be? His dad knew that it was a stumbling block, and better to throw the VCR out on the curb than to stumble. If you have a problem with the internet? Well, either get rid of the internet or get a filter. Folks, anything that affects your relationship with God, get rid of it. Now, I'm not saying your wife or your husband is so you get rid of them. You understand my point. But there are so many things that pull us away from God. Compromise is a big one. I know I've been harping on that lately, but it's because it's something that's just becoming so evident to me in my own life and in the life of people in the world at large is, you know, we're so willing to just shove God aside because we don't want to offend anyone. Heaven forbid I hurt somebody's feelings. And so we end up doing things that are wrong, that displease God. We would rather offend God than anyone else. Is there something wrong with that? Draw near to God and He will draw near to you. Seek God, folks. Encourage one another in that. Encourage me in my walk with God and encourage one another. Let's build one another up in the faith as we seek to pursue God and Christ's likeness. Jesus became the perfect example where Jesus said, He said, hate your mother and father. What a statement. What he's saying is that your relationship with God should supersede others to the point where it almost looks as though you hate your family because your love for God is so great. Now, shame on you if you hate your family. But get the point. Don't let anything stop you in your pursuing of God. But so many times, the least little thing trips us up because we're not pursuing it. Those who are old enough, you remember when they had the Gulf War and every night on the news they were talking about all the technology the Americans had and these sort of things? Remember those Patriot missile things? They were pretty cool. So, you know, they would send up one of those Scuds and all of a sudden this Patriot missile would come out of nowhere and it'd just get a bead on that rocket and it would just hound it down until it got it. We need to be like a Patriot missile with God. That we get a beat on God and nothing can distract us and we just keep moving and moving and moving and never turning from the target. Nothing will distract us in that pursuit. Nothing. And we need to encourage one another in that.